We're starting a new sermon series. The title is called Mistakes Worth Making, right? And that's a weird title. I've already had someone push back and say that's impossible because if it was worth making, then it wasn't a mistake. And technically that's true. What I mean is decisions, actions that from a particular perspective look like a mistake. And I'm suggesting they're the kind of mistakes Christians ought to make. So we're going to be looking at that for the next few Sundays. So I want to start this way with a really optimistic note. Humans are terrible at coming to accurate conclusions. We're terrible at it. We have lots of research to suggest that we do not do a good job reading other people well. We do a terrible job detecting deception in other people. We suffer from things like confirmation bias, where we're looking to find evidence that supports our view, but not the opposing side, right? Once we've come to an opinion, we want to endorse it or support it. Human beings are going to make lots and lots of mistakes. I make lots and lots of mistakes. I'm not as rational as I think. Humans are much more tribal than they are rational. We link with teams. Our psychology connects to teams. We want to defend and support our teams, right? Even if it's not overly rational. I'm much more emotional than rational, much more tribal. But this leads me into all kinds of error. It leads me to make all kinds of mistakes. Knowing that should cause me to live differently in the world. Should cause all of us to live a little differently in the world, I'm going to suggest. So first, I'm going to give you some nerdy data. We okay? This is what happens when you ask an academic to also be your pastor. Sometimes you get like evidence for things. Okay, so one of the things that humans do, we have lots of evidence for this in the social sciences, is called fundamental attribution error. Fundamental attribution error. So this is an easy one to highlight. This happens when you're driving down the road and someone cuts you off. Okay? You, most likely, if you're like me, do not say, "Man, I wonder what the unique situation is of that person's life that caused him to cut me off. Maybe he didn't see me. I was in his blind spot. Maybe his wife is having a baby or something." No. I say, "Jerk." Or worse, I said, rude, right? I make it a character trait of the person. That's what fundamental attribution error. I don't make it about the circumstances, I make it about the person and their character, okay? But I never do that with myself. When I cut someone off, which I do, it's almost always like, sorry, I didn't see you, right? And I say, "Oh man, I didn't see him, it was a mistake." But when someone else does it, I assume they're a jerk. Okay, that's what we do. We don't think about someone as being hurt, or we have no idea what their story is, or what their upbringing was like, or what they've had to deal with. We don't think about the circumstances that lead to much of our behavior. We assume the person is selfish, or they just make bad decisions. Why don't you just make better choices? We make all kinds of assumptions about the person as a whole, rather than think about all the contingent, one-off, circumstantial factors that led to their behavior. The more you know someone, the less you do this. So if you're my child, right? If you're my child, and Sullivan's teacher calls me and says, Sullivan got in trouble, which never happens, but hypothetically, she would call me, I immediately want her to know all the things that probably led to that behavior. That's not my son. He hasn't been sleeping well lately. There's been a lot of anxiety at home. This or that's happened. And I want her to see all of his complexity, all of his nuance. I don't want her to commit this and say, "Oh man, Sullivan, he's going to be in trouble all year long," right? Teachers do it. Pastors do it. We do it to coworkers, all of this. Well, here's the problem. You combine the way in which we make judgments about other people, which is usually we just broad strokes, we have a label. Of course, I'm complicated and nuanced, but other people are just one thing, right? You combine that with our tendency towards confirmation bias, which is I'm constantly searching for things that support my opinion. This is true of any moral belief, political belief, religious belief you have. You're searching for confirmation. You read things you disagree with more critically than you read things you agree with. So think about reading a newspaper article you agree with. You're like, oh, of course. You just kind of read it. If you don't agree, you're like, where did they get that information? Who wrote that? Where did they get that? You're more critical of what you disagree with than what you agree with. You confirm your bias. Well, if I've already made a judgment about someone, and then I'm looking for information to confirm that, I can almost always find it. There's almost always something else where I can read worst possible motives into them and say, oh, see, I knew it. They were a jerk. Right? Yeah. Rather than looking for all the ways where they might thwart my opinion of them and show me that they're actually really kind and complex and maybe they're just in a hurry. We don't read other people well. We don't judge other people well or fairly. Patricia mentioned the criminal justice system. This is what makes me very nervous about juries and other things. It's very hard to judge other people or to know their stories or to know what someone even deserves or how they got to this place. It's very hard to know that. Some people are legitimately evil and dangerous, and other people are not, and it's hard to know. Even people that are supposed to be really good at detecting lies or deception, like detectives, are notoriously bad at it. Right? So there's another fallacy. It's called the transparency error, but I'm going to show you two texts. If you're interested in this notion of how we get other human beings wrong, this might interest you. One is called Duped by Timothy Levine. His whole research program is just about deception, lying. How good are we at detecting it? How bad are we? How often do we do it to ourselves, right? Another book is called Talking to Strangers by Malcolm Gladwell. I just finished it. It's fascinating how bad we are at reading strangers, judging them appropriately, right? So one of the fallacies they talk about is the fallacy of transparency. Another word for it is the Friends fallacy. If you've ever seen an episode of Friends, the sitcom.
Yeah.
Friends, you can watch it on mute, and you'll know exactly what everyone's feeling at any given time because their face always matches their emotions. You can literally watch Friends in another language and you could still get the gist of what's happening, okay? Because when Ross is surprised, he goes like this. And when Joey's angry, he goes like this. It's very helpful. It's very helpful. This is how television operates. This is how some people operate, but most of us not. Most of us are not transparent. Most of the time, what we're feeling does not show up on our face. We're either not overly emotional people, we're more flat, or we're masking it on purpose. I don't want you to know what I'm thinking. The greatest gift in the world is that we can't read each other's minds, right? But our assumption is that people are transparent. Right? So I'm going to give you an example of how we just get things wrong with other people all the time. So Timothy Levine, he was the book Duped. What he does is he brings in college students to participate in a research project. They don't know what's even being researched for. They've got a hidden camera. They're watching. They're in this room. And there's a person who's giving them trivia questions. For every trivia question they get right, they get some money. Real money from a grant, right? So they're motivated to want to get as many right as they can. At some point, the researcher says, oh, I've got to leave the room for a minute. They get like a text, they leave the room, and they have an opportunity to cheat. The answers are just left right there on the table so they can look at them and get more answers right. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Well, they're filming, so they know who cheats and who doesn't, right? They know. Then they do interviews after it's all done, and they ask him directly, when I left the room, did you cheat? And they just want to see what they say. Some of the cheaters tell the truth, very few. Most of the cheaters lie. I didn't. I thought about it, but I didn't. You know, it was tempting. A lot of the students don't cheat. And then when they're asked, they say, no, I didn't cheat, right? Here's what Levine does. He just takes the videos of the people saying, I didn't cheat. He asks some follow-up questions. He gets them talking a little bit, right? He just has the video. Some people say, I didn't cheat, and they're telling the truth. Some people say I didn't cheat and they're lying. We all clear yet? Then he just shows people videos and says, are they lying or telling the truth? You tell me.
Oh.
That's it. He just wants to know how good are we at detecting liars? Okay?
Yeah.
Awful. Awful. Basically, we're coin flips, 50%, 51%. But here's what's interesting. Any person that is transparent, that is a student who says, No, I didn't cheat. I don't think I cheated, really. I mean, not a lot. That person, everyone gets. Liar. Everyone gets it 100% of the time, right? It's always the people that are mismatched we can't get. It's the people that seem like they're lying when they're not, which are a lot of people. They get nervous. They're being interviewed. They get asked, "Did you cheat?" And they're like, "Oh my gosh, no, I didn't cheat." "Ah, you're lying." "Nope, telling the truth." People that are confident, that look you in the eye, "No, I didn't cheat." People believe them, even though they lied. They did this for detectives. Do you know how well detectives are at catching the liars? 53%. 53%. Trained. We do not read people well. We make lots and lots and lots of mistakes. Okay. Why does that matter? I'm going to try to help you why this matters. You can't live life as though you're not going to make mistakes. I think a better question for you to ask yourself is, what mistakes are you okay making? What kinds of mistakes are you okay making? So I can tell you right now, as an example, like theologically, like one of the filters I just use is, can I live with that mistake? Women in ministry. Some churches don't think women should be in leadership, don't think women should be ordained, don't think they're fit for leadership. In the Methodist Church, we ordain women, which I'm so happy about. We believe in full equality of women. Awesome. But in my mind, theologically, what mistake am I okay making? Am I okay excluding women? And then what happens if I'm wrong about that? I would not feel okay with that. Do you see what I'm saying? If we exclude women and then it turns out God was like, "You had it all wrong," wow, that's a horrible mistake. We've eliminated half of the people from leadership. I don't want to make that mistake. If we fully embraced women in leadership and we tried to provide opportunity, love, support, and then it was like, "Oh, we got that wrong." Okay, well, I'm okay with that mistake. I'm okay with mistakes of inclusion. I'm very rarely okay with mistakes of exclusion. If we exclude and we're wrong, that's a problem. Right? If we include and we're wrong, that's a problem, but it's less of a problem. Since I'm going to be wrong a lot and I'm going to make lots of mistakes about people, I want to make mistakes I'm okay living with. So here's my suggestion. If you're going to make a mistake, be overly gracious. Make a mistake on the side of mercy, not judgment. Make a mistake on the side of grace, not punishment. Be overly gracious to the people in your life and read best motives into their lives and their actions. When you're hurt by someone, ask yourself, what if I read the best possible motive into that person's words or actions? With a coworker, it's your mom, it's your dad, it's a sibling, it's a child. What if I thought about them in the most gracious terms possible and then interpreted what they just said? I might be wrong. Maybe they were trying to be a jerk. I might be wrong. But that's a mistake worth making. Do you want to know what mistake I don't want to make? They meant it. They tried to hurt me. They're mean, selfish, or wicked. And if I'm wrong about that, that's a much worse mistake. You're going to get people wrong. You're going to evaluate humans wrong. You're going to evaluate the people you know best wrong. Default to grace. Default to truth. Last week we talked about having grace for ourselves, trying to accept the grace of God. And now I'm suggesting we extend that to other people. How many of you have bitterness, anger, broken relationships, difficulty with people? I'm suggesting to maybe reevaluate that in light of what kinds of mistakes are you okay making. Like, think about, like, if I'm on my deathbed, I don't want to make the mistake of not forgiving the people I love and excluding them, right? I'd rather make the mistake of including jerks and make the mistake of forgiveness. Sometimes forgiveness is a mistake. Okay, pause, asterisk, footnote. I am not suggesting that any of you allow yourself to be victimized. I am not suggesting that you allow yourself to be in a bad, abusive, verbally, emotionally, physically, otherwise, relationship with someone and say, "Just give them more grace. Just give them more." I'm not saying that. No. Don't hear me say that. Christians are not called to be doormats. Christians are not called to have no boundaries. That's not what I'm saying. We have to use wisdom when this person is not safe for me. Okay, they're not safe. And when we need to provide grace. And I can't answer that question for you. Just know that I'm not telling you to accept whatever abuse someone shovels at you. That's not what I'm saying. But let's default to grace as much as we can. This is what Joseph does. So Joseph is wronged deeply by his brothers, sold into slavery, and ends up in Egypt. And I guarantee he would not have been able to provide forgiveness of his brothers if he had that confrontation with them a week later. Years have gone by from when Joseph gets sold into slavery and when Joseph interacts with his brothers again in Egypt, where Joseph has power and Joseph has the upper hand. Years have gone by. But do you hear what Joseph says? I know what you intended, but I also know what God intended. Like, I see you clearly, maybe more clearly than you see yourself, that you're more than just brothers that sold me into slavery, right? Like, you did this in part because you were afraid and you were jealous and you were angry, which means you're lost and broken and separated from God. And I can see what you need is actually forgiveness and grace, not my judgment. Joseph errs on the side of grace. That's how he and his brothers are able to be reconciled. And I guarantee what happened to Joseph is worse than what's ever happened to me, right? We're going to watch a clip from a movie. It's old. Kevin Costner is the star. It's like a young Elijah Wood. It's called The War. And it really is a long, sort of 2-hour-long commentary on war in its various forms. The dad, Kevin Costner, has been to Vietnam. He's now come home. His son, Elijah Wood, is at war with his neighbors. They're all living in the South. Racism is a problem. Poverty for both of these families is a problem. But Elijah Wood is sort of in this battle with these boys that live next door, this family. But Elijah Wood at least has a dad that loves him. They're poor, but his dad loves him, right? These boys have a dad that's a drunk and abusive. They basically live in a junkyard and are feral children, right? But Elijah Wood can't see that. He's a boy himself, and so they have this clash. The scene takes place. They're at an auction trying to get a house they might be able to afford because it's on the auction block. So Elijah Wood and his dad go to put their name in, to put their bid in, right, for the auction. And you sort of see what takes place in the midst of this as Elijah Wood now confronts these boys again. They've had a long history with each other. That's how you default to grace. I wouldn't blame Kevin Costner for thinking those kids are rotten. I mean, there's a history of animosity and violence. They are beating up his son. So I'm going to ask you, this is my congregational question, right? What does Kevin Costner see? What does he see when he looks at those children?
Himself. Maybe himself.
Maybe himself? He's no saint?
Kind.
Maybe.
Chains.
Chains, why? What kind of chains?
They've been enslaved to a system or brokenness.
Yeah, he looks at them and sees them as kids who have been raised a particular way. You should see the dad in the movie. Their dad is awful, right? They're poor, they're broken.
Doing what the dad does.
Yeah, they're like paying it forward. You think kids are just born rotten? That seems like a tough pill to swallow if you're in education at all. It's hard to look at kids that are hard. Ask Jenny how difficult it is to work with certain children. But you have to see past their behavior, their anger, their cruelty to you, and they're hurt, lost, chained, broken. That's what he sees. That's defaulting to grace. But I hate to say this. I don't even like to believe it sometimes, but it's true. Do you know what children become? Adults who are broken and hurting and in pain and in the dark, and they need us to default to grace, to look at them just that way, not just as kids who beat up my son, not just as kids who are mean or cruel or bitter, as kids who need love. That's how, because they just grow up to be adults, that's it. But I don't know how willing I am to do that. Kids, okay, not adults. Why? Jesus doesn't just provide grace to children. He provides grace to adults. Joseph doesn't provide grace to children. He provides it to adults. And I think as much as I'm in need of grace, I need to offer it. So we're going to come to the table today, the communion table. And when you come, I want you to think about something very specific. I want you to think about